trusty money remains the bedrock of stability. The soul of money is trust.
I think we are not paying sufficient attention to the law of unintended consequences.
In the immortal words of the Doors, the time to hesitate is through.
Rigel, aka Coinshaw, how are you, man? What's happening?
Not too bad. Just enjoying an unusually cold day here in Mexico City.
Yeah,
getting
right.
Some work done. It's better. Yeah.
Unusually cold is. Oh, we won't go there. how did you discover Bitcoin?
So for me, when I first, I made my first Bitcoin purchase. Not long after really kind of discovering it, I guess to define discover, I will say that's not when you first heard the word. That's like when you first like decided this was something worth, and you know, spending some time investigating and some attention on. Mm. So to me, that was October, September 2014, I think. And so prior to that, I had heard of Bitcoin. You know, I'd seen around. I remember in New Zealand where I'm from. At the time, I definitely remember there was something in the newspaper about there was a Bitcoin ATM that opened up. It was late 13, early 14, I can't remember. And I'd done a little dabble. I never really succeeded very much at it, but I dabbled a little like some making money online stuff. And there were a couple of things that paid out in Bitcoin. So I think I kind of heard of it through that. But like what really, you know, got me interested in it, what, you know, kind of got my attention and got me serious about it was reading about the trial of Ross Ulbricht. I think it was in the sentencing portion that would have been at that time of post Silk Road. So before that, you know, I kind of dismissed Bitcoin without really doing any kind of reading about it. It's like, oh, this, you know, silly fake money or whatever, you know. Again, I didn't really know what my opinion was. I just remember dismissing it. But when I read about the Silk Road, I was like, wow, this is really amazing. Because, you know, in the past, I was a police officer for 10 years. And so to read about how the Silk Road and how it operated and the fact that, you know, all the government agencies in the United States couldn't shut this down and operated with impunity, more or less until, you know, what appeared to be some sort of classic human obstacle failures let it down. To me, that was a very significant thing. And you know, I was like, wow, this is some real nuclear grade, you know, nuclear weapons grade technology here. If you can operate, you know, with all the power of the most powerful nation in the world can't stop it, that's something really serious. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, that was kind of what initially got me interested in it. And it was more, you know, it was more darknet markets, to be honest, was, you know, what I was really interested in, you know, not so much Bitcoin itself, but I was like, wow, there's this place online where, you know, I didn't know about Tor or anything like this. And I was like, wow, these things exist where you can like buy and sell drugs and all this nefarious stuff goes on this channel. It's like super interesting. Let's go and have a look. So really, you know, what kind of my initial interest and how I got interested into Bitcoin was through darknet markets. And that was through reading about the Silk Road trial and Ross Ulbricht's thing there.
Yeah. Right. As an ex police officer, was it from a sort of an investigative standpoint or was there a bit of personal curiosity there? Like, what was the sort of the interrelationship between what was feeding that curiosity? That
yeah, I mean, to me, like, I never really joined the police because I was particularly interested in saving the world or, you know, I thought it was some noble profession or whatever. I was just like 20 years old and I thought, well, you know, I wasn't really interested in going to university. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I was already in the army part-time and I was weighing that up pretty seriously. And I was going to be an officer in the army. But in New Zealand, they only do an annual intake for that. And because I was already, it's like in the reserves as just a regular soldier, I apply, but because of the amount of time it takes to go through all the red tape, or like your commanding officer sending up the chain and come all the way back down, I got this message saying, yeah, I've been accepted for the officer selection board, which started a week ago when I got the notification. So like I was going to have to wait a whole year to become an officer in the Army. And I thought, well, you know, I'm 20, fuck that. I'm not waiting a whole year for this thing, which, you know, is the selection board to maybe get on the officer cadet school to maybe become an officer if you pass all those things, right? So, you know, so I started looking at some other options, you know, because really I just wanted to do some, you know, I was younger, I read a lot of Nietzsche and shit like this. And so, you know, I was just interested in a life built on action and experiencing the world through real danger. And that's what grows the human spirit and intelligence and all these kind of things. So it seemed to me that, you know, the police was the best option. And, you know, I was more interested in a personal development sense rather than anything else. So, you know, I did that for 10 years, and that's a whole nother side story we could talk about, you know, for hours and hours. But basically, you know, I got to the point where I'm like, holy shit, I've been here for 10 years, or almost 10 years, and you know, I never intended to stay here this long. If I don't quit, you know, at some point I'm going to be doing this forever because it's one of those sort of jobs. So I just left on 10 years and a day. So yeah, you know, I had that experience, and to me it was more about learning about yourself and about how the world works and, you know, dealing with real danger, real, you know, risk and things like that there, and understanding that. And so when I read about the Silk Road, you know, I wasn't interested, you know, I'm somewhat, I guess you could say, amoral about the idea of law and order. Like I'm more or less contradictory as it may sound, always been like more or less an anti-government kind of guy, and, you know, believe in the power of the individual, and that's, you know, kind of the ultimate deciding force of humanity or human civilization or whatever it may be. So to me, you know, it was more just out of pure interest of understanding, and this is, I think, you know, go back to like when I was younger and reading a lot of Nietzsche and stuff like this, it was what really got me interested in the Army and the police was that understand the dynamics of power, and that like at a base level, maybe morally you wouldn't agree with this, but physically might is right, right? In the sense of like, you know, if you have the ultimate control of violence, then you decide what happens in the world. And that's really the way that human beings operate. So, you know, that was kind of what got me interested in the police and the Army. And this is also what got me interested in Bitcoin, in that, you know, I don't really view these things in terms of like, is it morally correct or is it right or wrong to sell drugs? Or is that, you know, that's like a side issue to me. What's really interesting is here is a technology which operates like a weapon system in the terms of like, it allows you to do something with impunity, and no one can stop you from doing it. The same way that if you perhaps were to have a firearm and you were the only person, you would go in a primitive society where they had bow and arrows and you had a firearm, right? It doesn't matter what people think about what you do. It doesn't matter, you know, whether this is right or this is wrong. The simple physics is, means that you can do certain things that other people can't do, and no one can really stop you, right? And so in that sense, you know, I saw Bitcoin was clearly a tool which you know operated by those same principles. I'm very hesitant to use the Jason Lowry kind of terminology, and I'm not a particularly big fan of the dude, but I mean, I think objectively speaking, you can make that argument, and it's hard to argue with the physical reality of what I just said. So
yeah, it's interesting. A little while back you mentioned just the ultimate arbiter of action is the individual. And interestingly enough, that seems in this day and age like a controversial statement, right? And yet it's categorically, objectively true. It must be, right? Mm-hmm. The only reason we're doing this podcast right now is because we've both decided on our list of preferences of things to do today that we value having this conversation at some point higher up on the list. And it's like, I find that fascinating that Bitcoin enables the individual to enact those value preferences in such a way that's more confident and more sure, say, of the future in terms of its uncertainties and so on and so forth. And then, you know, with respect to what you were just talking about, power and things, I'm not totally familiar with a lot of that stuff. I did read a little bit of Michel Foucault back in uni, and I found him to be a little bit full of shit, to be honest. I don't know. I couldn't articulate why. And there was a few other French philosophers like Bourdieu talking about habitus and things like this. But once I read Mises and started to understand the concept of praxeology, it was like game over. This is the bottom of the barrel right here. This is where we start from. And so it's interesting. So you weren't necessarily, I mean, God, that's an anomaly to join the police force, and no disrespect to the police force, but I mean, I can't imagine there's too many police officers joining with prior knowledge of Nietzsche and this sort of thing and thinking it about from an intellectual angle. You know what I'm saying?
It's a small percentage, yeah.
So you discovered Bitcoin and you appreciated the concept of the power it enabled to transact online to purchase products, etc.
I mean, I wouldn't even kind of phrase it that way. I'd say it's as simple as, and this is, I think, some people kind of touch upon this in some memes on Bitcoin, on Twitter and stuff. You read like, it's not that people aren't going to use Bitcoin because they want to, they're going to use it because they have to. And I wouldn't necessarily, you know, I'm someone who at this point in time is not convinced that hyper Bitcoinization or these kind of things will come to pass. Not to say that things couldn't change that convince me of that, but I don't believe that from what I've seen. And, you know, I kind of talked about that to some degree on the Honey Badger talk that you and I were discussing on Twitter. But to me, I think it's in terms of, you know, the darknet markets are a great example of like that. That type of commerce could not exist without these tools, right? You know, so I think I'm sure that most of the merchants on Silk Road, for example, did not actually want Bitcoin. They just wanted dollars. And this was simply a payment rail or a means for that to take place, but it could not take place without Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think probably, I'm not sure of all, but probably a percentage of those people started with that view, and then when they really came to understand what Bitcoin is and how it works and think deeply about it, they realized this is actually the money I want to accumulate, or this is what I want to have. Maybe not 100%, but certainly more than nothing, which was the starting point, right? If I just want to cash this out to dollars and get my money and whatever, you know, like. So I mean, I think in that sense, it's something where you use it, or it's useful and has a place because, you know, there is no alternative, that, you know, you can't stop it, that for this particular use case and when Bitcoin is being used in general. You know, I mean, there's plenty of edge case exceptions we could talk about, but I think it's like a relatively fair generalization. So, you know, you can't stop it, right? And so for people who put a value on that, it is the only option, and therefore it becomes the best money, and it is the only way to transact, right? So I mean, I feel like to kind of speak to that point, it's something that that people get because they live in this might sound like a little diminutive to people who are otherwise, but people who live in the real world, let's just say, you know, people who deal with force and violence and the threat of their money being taken away, or threat of freedom of trade being taken away from them on some level, be that, you know, like they're selling drugs online, or be that simply they live in a poor country and, you know, their current fiat options do not offer the same level of freedom as Bitcoin. You know, that is why people use, and that's the attraction to it. And I think that's kind of why at this stage it's still a minority thing and will be, unless things significantly change, because, you know, I think Bitcoin for people in Western nations is a shittier money, really. I mean, maybe you can argue that it's limited supply or whatever, but, you know, even those things, I think they're somewhat dependent on subjective valuation. You know, some people will crucify me for me saying that thing, but, you know, the idea that Bitcoin itself has any inherent value is, and that thing is still up for question. But, I mean, I believe that objectively it does, and it's very clear that it has that, it's that freedom money, and it has that those inherent properties which are better than fiat money. And the only reason that dollars are easier for people to use is because of the infrastructure that surrounds it, right? You know, it's only a better money for us because, A, it's more stable because it's what everyone uses, and it's backed by economic apparatus that keeps it at stable value, but also, you know, there's all the infrastructure about banks, PayPal, or whatever that makes it simpler to use. But if you live in Africa, that is not true, right?
Right.
So, I mean, that's why I think like Bitcoin is objectively a bit of money, but for people that don't, that have, you know, Western privileges, let's put it that way, I don't think those objectively better principles are really apparent or useful to them. And unless that changes, I struggle to see how it is going to reach that level of need, or it's going to have that kind of appeal that it has to everyone else, where it's something that you must use because you need it.
Yeah, right. I mean, I guess it's all about problem solving at the end of the day. So depending on where you are, you know, you either, it solves a problem in the fact that it's a useful medium of exchange. If you're in Africa, we had Bitcoin Data on a couple of episodes back. And otherwise, you know, in my case, being in Australia, it's not the greatest medium of exchange because you spend quite a lot of sats when you buy a coffee. But it's more a novelty to try and maybe orange pill your barista or whatever. But in terms of problem solving for saving, you know, and not being fucked by a crappy term deposit or, hyperinflating house prices or something, it's actually incredibly useful. And
in some ways, yeah, in some ways not. You know, I'd counter that in the terms of like, if that's the only thing you got to say, right, is that its speculative value is better than term deposit, there's always going to be something that has the possibility to outcompete it because, you know, you can say what you like about fixed supply, but the simple fact of the matter is, and this is very clear from what happened with FTX and many other things, is that there is a lot of paper Bitcoin that exists out there. And so, like, it is not uninflatable unless everyone self-sovereign holds their coins. And the more that people are using it, you know, normies are using it just as wealth preservation, the more that is not going to take place because, you know, the more people that get on board, the lower the average level of intelligence, and the less more people are going to defer that custody to third parties, which of course are going to, you know, operate on fractional reserves and things like that. So I mean, I feel like, to me, like, you know, believe me, I might sound like I'm a skeptic here, and I'm absolutely not. Like, you know, 99.9% of my money is in Bitcoin, but you know, that is because for me, that I understand the inherent value of it, and that it is because of, you know, as we talked about, you know, how I discovered Bitcoin. Right from the start, you know, I saw like, this is the weapons grade money, right? You know, this is the stuff that no one can stop. And I put a very high value on freedom and, you know, maybe I'm a little paranoid too. And so to me, this was like, even forgetting about the price appreciation from the point that I bought it, this is just where I feel, I don't know, spiritually, morally, principally aligned with keeping the amount of my money in it. The same way that maybe if you were some rabid environmentalist, right, you would want most of your money in some, you know, green stocks or something like an that idea. Because, you know,
sustainable.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'm not that person, but you know what I mean? Like, you would feel that, what is the point of money other than to serve the things in the world that you philosophically align with? Obviously, you don't want to like throw it away, you know, but at the same time, something that's a good marriage between preservation of capital and, you know, feeding principles and causes that you believe in. So to me, you know, I think for me, it was that if to come back to what we were saying, if it's only just about savings, you know, there's plenty of ways that its detractors or just even forgetting about that, it's free market forces can now compete that, right? You know. But, you know, the difference is that, you know, despite what its detractors would say, there is real intrinsic value in Bitcoin, and that is the network. That is the technology itself, so that currently exists, the hash rate, you know, the distribution of nodes, the philosophy and the community around it, the amount of people that have seen this thing, which was a fantasy for so many years, and the cypherpunks wrote about, you know, this can actually work, and this does work, and this is the shelling point, which is Bitcoin, right? You know, all these altcoins just detract from the idea of like, here is the one thing, let's all put our energy behind it, and this is the principle, you know, which will succeed if we are more aligned with, again, the idea of Bitcoin rather than, maybe I can take my Bitcoin and buy shitcoin X and make a little bit more money. And that's, you know, what detracts from that principle, right? So I believe that there is an inherent value to Bitcoin, and that's why I keep my money in it. And that's, why other things might go up and down, I want to keep my money there. But I think if you only see it as a savings vehicle and you don't understand the principles around that, right? You know, you don't have that that reason that makes you like a holder of last resort and makes you keep your money in this thing, because it's not about the money, it's about a bigger principle and feeding into something like that. That is what makes it a bit, it's somewhat of a chicken and egg kind of phenomena, right? But to come back to how started on this whole thing, I mean, I think for a lot of Western people, they don't understand this because, you know, like, again, to use that term, you know, they don't live in a world where they experience the real threat, or they're not, they have a relatively comfortable existence, right? You know, and I've had some experiences which have shown me how fickle and thin and brittle that foundation under what that exists is.
Yeah.
And to come back to what you were saying about, you know, say Australia and certainly New Zealand, I mean, I think, look, you know, our countries in particular have had a very good wake-up call in the last couple of years of, you know, like how many things that you took for granted can be taken away just like that. And, you know, to me, you know, I was very fortunate. I feel very fortunate that I had my previous life experience before that. Because when I saw some of the things happening with COVID, I was like, get the fuck out of here now. Because, you know, in the end, you know, I mean, I don't think it could have been a hell of a lot worse than things have been the last couple of years about the way that things could have turned. But, I mean, I think it's a wake-up call to a lot of people who assume that, you know, that these freedoms that they have are just there forever and they can't be taken away. And then you have an experience like, say, you or I, where if you're outside the country, you can't even go back to your fucking country where you're a passport and you're a citizen. You know what I mean? It's a wake-up call. And I think those things reinforce the value of something like Bitcoin, right? And you see that can exist. This is why you need this stuff, which might seem like overly paranoid or crazy to the average person. When you see something like that, you're like, no, man, this is not fucking crazy at all. Like, this is how close the line is, and this is how thin the veneer of safety and stability is that we have, and also just how quickly that can change. And if you're not on board, as another, you know, kind of meme from Twitter, you know, you gotta, if you're not on board the ship when it starts sailing away, you know, it's gonna be too late, right? So for all those reasons, you know, I think it has inherent value, and to me it makes a lot of sense. But you know, I feel until a lot more people get on board with that, that, you know, that like surety about its value and its appreciation are a lot more driven by speculation than they are by inherent value.
Yeah, no, indeed. That's the bridge that ultimately it compels you to cross, and there's a lot of resistance at that bridge. You come in for the gains, and you use it as a savings vehicle, and speculate, as you say. And then once you actually dive a little bit deeper and you discover some of those little trails and warrens that branch off from the initial rabbit hole that you've found yourself in, then it's up to you to pursue that and hopefully be curious and open-minded enough to allow it to defrag. And if you can come up with counter arguments and counterfactuals, then that's cool, and, you know, present them as required. But interestingly enough, in my journey, I've had all the skeptical questions and come up against these hurdles. And then you talk to someone on Bitcoin Twitter or whatever, and they'll say, well, go check this out, read that first, or, you know, whatever. And it's interesting to me that it's provided you are open-minded and curious enough, then you can meet that bridge and cross it with a lot more ease. And so then you get to the bigger idea of what Bitcoin is representative of, mm-hmm. as opposed to just, you know, Lambos, you know?
Yeah.
So with that in mind, you know, why do you think that you are open-minded and curious enough to be able to discover Bitcoin?
Because, yeah, I mean, I think I always have been. If you talk to, like, people that know me for a long time, I'm someone that's quite individualistic, and you know, some of the things I've done in my life that I've combined are not very usual things for one person to do at the same time or to do within their lifetime. Not saying that I'm some superhero or amazing, but just simply the diversity of interests that to the outside observer don't really have any sort of connection. So to me, you know, I think I've always been quite open-minded and wanting to entertain different things, and that certainly that hasn't always been a positive trait about some things, you know, which are difficult to communicate or don't make sense to other people. And I think, you know, it might make sense to you, but if you can't communicate that, there's a certain limited amount of utility to it, right? But I mean, I think Bitcoin is one of these things which made, you know, once I got it, like I said, made obvious sense to me. But it's definitely the thing out of all the niche interests I've had in my life that has a lot more kind of meme power and appeal to the average person. And simply the fact that it's almost like a sort of like self-fueling economy or like a meme that pays itself in a sense, right? Like, to be as cynical as possible about it, you know, the more that you pump Bitcoin and shove it down the throats of people and orange pull people, the higher the price goes and the richer you get. So like a Ponzi scheme in a sense, you know, and in some ways you can make that argument. And so like it's
although a we should powerful. Just be clear for anyone that's listening that's new, it is actually actively not a Ponzi. We do know that.
But I mean,
it is a Ponzi now that I've said that.
but I mean, you could. The thing is like unless you address this right, you know, you've got to meet these things head on, right?
Right.
And you could say like, just like I've explained, like Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme, right? You know, that it's simply like, was it the Greater Fool theory? You know, like, you know, it's just built on the next demo guy getting on board and, you know, like all classic pyramid schemes, right? But the difference is that there is like the network is what makes it different, right? You know, think about it if Bitcoin was just like PayPal or something on SQL database, absolutely it is. But, you know, there is a real intrinsic value and an intrinsic product behind this. And it's not just the limited supply of Bitcoin, you know, tokens or Bitcoins, which again, you know, without the network and without the culture behind it is, you could just go change the code and everyone agreed to make twice the amount of Bitcoins and everyone ran a node, you know, which did that. And that became the what everyone decided was Bitcoin and trade and exchanges of Bitcoin. The Bitcoin would have, you know, 42 million coins instead of 21, right? You know, but it's the belief and it's the technology and those two things almost like in a yin and yang combination that creates something which, you know, it is not a Ponzi scheme. I mean, it has the reliance on like belief makes it stronger, and the more people that get on board, you know, the higher the price goes. But that's like many phenomena in economics where there is a limited supply, right? You know, the only way that these things, Well, it's slightly different because with other other things like this, right? You can just make more, right? You know, right. And the difference to Bitcoin, and this is why I believe, you know, it's going to be volatile for a very, very long time. It's unable to be responsive to supply and demand, right? You know, like, you know, there's, you know, like a little incremental increase in hash rate or a drastic increase in hash rate can create a small incremental increase in the speed or the amount of Bitcoin that is released into the economy in the next week, month, year, whatever it might be. But there's only a finite number that can ever exist. And that thing, again, you know, the difficulty adjustment will handle that and scale it back, right? So no matter how many people want Bitcoin, there is only ever going to be so much that exists, and there's only going to be so much that is able to come out and meet that demand, right? So in other economical models, you know, you've got a lot of people who want to buy a phone. Like I said, we just start up a new phone company, you get a new factory, you hire some new employees, right? Bitcoin, it's not really possible. So I mean that's why, you know, that it is different from some of these other economic behaviors, and why, you know, people might make the Ponzi analogy, but it's actually more like an economic phenomena of something which is almost unknown in our world, which is like, you know, predictable, limited, finite supply or something.
Yeah, and that is a remarkable thing to think about when you do touch on that, which I mean it's kind of as you alluded to earlier, which is it's like fuck you money. It's you cannot change it. I mean, you can technically change it, but like, have you seen how many nodes are existed that we at least are known of, the ones that aren't running on Tor? You know, good luck. Let's have a vote, huh? Like, it's not going to happen.
But I mean, that in itself is an interesting phenomenon too, because like I said, and this is kind of what I talked about in my Honey Badger talk, right? You know, that what you're saying is that the Bitcoin is like it is because of the strength of the network and the amount of nodes which will reject invalid transactions that do not meet the consensus rules of the network that they're enforcing, right? But I mean, that's just because people are running software, right? And if you were somehow, you know, this sounds totally counterintuitive and against people's interests, but let's just imagine it's possible, you're able to convince all node operators or majority of node operators to run some software which doubled the supply of Bitcoin. That is what Bitcoin is, and the supply, you know, so this is not some invincible thing which can't be changed. It absolutely can be changed. You know, the only reason that Bitcoin is what it is the software that is run, and kind of like the great quote from Eric Voskuhle that I kind of used in my talk there. It's like that software is run by people who switch a computer on and make sure that the computer is running and keep it running, right? And without that, that, you know, then it falls to the people who, you know, want to get into your room and switch on the computer and install some other software and take up the network, right? So you know, Bitcoin is like it is because of technology, but it's also because of the culture around it, right? And the amount of the people that believe in what it is and believe in the principles of things like, say, 21 million. And so that, in that sense, it's a very interesting meme in that, like, it's robust software for sure, but the reason that it is, has that, you know, that strength of the network is that strong, there's that many nodes running, there's this amount of hash power, is because, you know, people are, A, motivated by some basic game theoretical things that Bitcoin includes, like greed. You know, like, if you reinforce this thing, well, you're going to get richer and it's going to benefit you, so why would you not give your energy to it? But also, you know, it's some ideas that are, like, simple enough to catch on with people that are not particularly intelligent or, like, super smart. You know, obviously Bitcoin is a very deep technical rabbit hole where, you know, if you're some supercomputer genius, you can go down forever and get deeper and deeper. But, you know, you don't need to be smart to see the value of the idea and the meme. And that's partly because of what Bitcoin is inherently, you know, right from day one. But it's also the stories that we tell ourselves and the way that, you know, Bitcoiners have still manned a narrative. And I think that's one thing that's done better than all of its competitors, let's say, for example, Ethereum, Litecoin, Monero, whatever you want to pick up, right? None of them have the stories and the steel man arguments and the culture that Bitcoin does. And that's why Bitcoin is so strong. And that's why I don't see any possibility of it being overtaken by those kind of things. Because you look at them, all their best stuff they take from Bitcoin, you know, as far as the arguments that you'll see them trying to convince newcomers or outsiders with, right? They're all arguments that have become Bitcoiners. Even something like Ethereum, where, you know, like I call it the infinite narrative generator, right? Because, you know, this week it's like ICOs, next week it's NFTs, next week it's, you know, DeFi or whatever. And there will be many more to come as long as Ethereum exists. But that narrative is always quite a thin, immature, undeveloped one. And because it changes all the time, you know, people don't really know what Ethereum is anywhere near as clearly as Bitcoin. Any of the arguments they might steal from Bitcoin about sound money or this or that, censorship resistance, they fall away very quickly because Ethereum does not have those things anywhere near that's approaching what Bitcoin does. So, I mean, you know, that strength is inherent to the technology, but it's also inherent to the culture. And the culture is the people who run the machines. And the reason they run the machines and the reason they run their code is because of what they believe. And so, you know, these two things are very tightly integrated together. And kind of what I want to talk about, like Honey Badger, was, you know, I think that's very poorly and naively understood by people. And it's a very deep rabbit hole, and it's very fundamental to the strength of Bitcoin about understanding those two things, because without the belief, without the culture, without the clear understanding about what Bitcoin is, which is something which, you know, if you look at the percentage of the world that owns Bitcoin and that really understands it, that's a much even smaller population. The more people that come on board, which is far bigger than the people that currently here, if they don't understand, they don't believe it, what Bitcoin becomes can be totally warped and changed from what we think it is. Because, you know, what it is an emergent consensus, right? You know, in the next minute, if everyone is running a different code base than what Bitcoin is, or they run some fork, or, you know, they integrate a new version that changes some things, like, you know, the RBF change that's recently gone through, great example, right? You know, here's what Bitcoin was before. Now Bitcoin is something fundamentally different, right? And a lot of people, they're not even aware, they're not cognizant of this kind of stuff, but they have, that one, for example, has some very profound ramifications depending on how you use Bitcoin and what it means to you. And I think there's, like, very little discussion about this kind of stuff, which, you know, is really critical to the future security of Bitcoin and where it goes from here, because I think the technology is really not going to break. I mean, maybe there's some critical vulnerability we don't know about yet, which will come through, but I mean, I think, like, you know, that we're at the point now where people would just if it was really, really bad, they would change, you know, the consensus algorithm, or even most people would agree to roll back the chain to that particular point where things broke and then continue on, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that the technology is at this point somewhat of a second, you know, we've got that thing relatively covered. It's relatively done. You know, it's going to always be better. There can always be improvements. There's always, you know, the work is never done as a software developer. I definitely know that. But, you know, that's not the real problem here. The real problem is the culture of the people that run the nodes, because that's what Bitcoin is, right? Because Bitcoin is what people are running in that particular moment, and what the next block says Bitcoin is, really is what terms it is, right? So culture is fundamentally important to Bitcoin, and very few people talk about this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little off topic from the overall concept of the pod, but I think you're probably one of the best people to speak to about. I always have thought about this concept of the pump, where these cultural things, and you did mention this, is why I reached out to you on that from that Baltic Honey Badger, is that you get a subculture of individuals, say in and around Seattle, and the grunge movement crops up, and you get bands like Alice in Chains and Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, Nirvana leads the pack, right? That blows it all wide open into the mainstream. And then it gets co-opted, and you get Puddle of Mud and Stained and the Silverchair and all the rest of it. And then you fast forward a few years later and you get Avril Lavigne and fucking like all of this other stuff. And it's just, it's constantly watered down to the point where it's now salient again for the mainstream culture. And I always think about things like that, where, you know, if you're an OG grunge kid from around Seattle back in the day in the late 80s and early 90s, and you see what grunge became, say, by 94, you're going to probably be retracing back to some other underground thing that is yours now. And it's kind of almost akin to when the Beatles were playing around the Cavern Club and you had all of the Liverpudlians going there and watching them. It was their band, and they knew who the Beatles were. And the next minute they fly over to the States, they play Ed Sullivan, and it's the world's now. And they feel individually like they've lost something, because it's no longer their little secret anymore. And we're not quite at that point. I mean, people know Bitcoin. It's a household name. But I feel like there's a similar sort of simmering of culture that align with those sorts of examples within the Bitcoin space, where it's like the thing that's mine, and I know about it, and you know, I want to share it and see it grow and succeed, and yet I don't want it to get too popular, man. Oh, it's sold out. Bitcoin's sold out, bro. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Totally. I mean, but you know, dude, you know, I really don't think it is actually getting off topic that much about the topic of, you know, the pod here, because I mean, this was really what got me really interested in Bitcoin. And like, you know, for a lot of people, there was probably levels or steps of this, right? Where the first, like, really got into Bitcoin, and then they got more into it, and they started working in the space, they started putting all their money in it or whatever. So there's levels about like discovering or getting into Bitcoin, right? Mm-hmm. And so to me, when I first read about, like, you know, and got on, you know, at the time it was like Evolution and Agora were the, you know, big darknet markets, and bought some drugs and stuff, you know, to see how it worked. And like, you know, to me, that was very interesting, and it's a technology that I want to learn about. But like, you know, I like to smoke a bit of weed or whatever, and, you know, take the odd acid trip or whatever. But like, I'm not like, well, I wasn't interested because I want to buy a ton of drugs and sell it, or even that I wanted the drugs. It was more like the novelty of like how this thing works, right? And so if that had been all it was, it would have been like the guns I had in my gun closet, right, where it sits there. Maybe take it out every once in a while to go to the range and do shooting. But I mean, it's not like something that's really fundamentally part of your life. And the stuff that we were just talking about with music, right? It was the part of like when I really understood, where I really started to get the idea of like, this is a whole subculture, and the way that, because no one is in charge of it, everyone is in charge of it. And this is like an emergent thing. Like an example I made in another article, it's like, say, tell me who owns rap music. Like no one. No one owns it, right? No one owns it, and everyone owns it in a sense, right? Maybe you could say, well, these record labels or these artists, but if they fuck up, you know, if they don't put out good music, some new guy is going to come up and take that power away from them, right? And Bitcoin is very much the same kind of thing, right? Where, as you're saying, you know, I believe, you know, this is so, so early and immature that, you know, it's hard to even picture this. But I mean, you already see this, right? Where there's some people on Bitcoin on Twitter who'll be like, oh, you know, some guys just got into the space, and they, to them, like Ethereum, Bitcoin, you know, Ripple, the stuff is all the same. And you got some guy who's like, no, no, Bitcoin's to anyone, dude. Like, read this, you know, this is how it is, you know, this is why it's sound money and stuff from this kind of stuff. And then you have someone underneath that who's like the no KYC Bitcoin guy, or say, well, no, this all bullshit, dude. You're buying your Bitcoin with KYC, and that's not real Bitcoin. Like, and so, you know, I think that like that will come out, and that is already coming out. It's a very kind of important part of if you want to take it back to the topic of the pod, discovering Bitcoin. People are constantly discovering what that is and getting a deeper understanding. And like when I look back at myself, like when I first got into it, there's some things which I thought or believed, you know, that clearly were contradictory ideas, that these two things can exist, and you know, that this thing you believe in this, you know, for example, I got to it for all the you know, kind of decentralized illegal kind of reasons, if you like. And then, you know, like I remember this would have been September or something, and then I heard about Ripple in December, and I was like, of course the banks are going to use it, yeah, of course, you know, like many people, right? Now these two things obviously are completely contradictory to each other, right, or more or less contradictory to each other. But you know, at the time, I just didn't see this, what is now a very clearly, you know, glaringly contradictory idea. I had to discover Bitcoin again and again and again on deeper and deeper levels about what this really means, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think this is a very important part of like discovering Bitcoin, because, you know, you're probably having this podcast, or someone else will be doing a version of this podcast in 10 years. And what discovering Bitcoin will mean is a very different thing than just like discovering Bitcoin, right? You know, like the connotations are very different. So I mean, I think that is you know, it was what really got me interested into the space was when I started to see the kind of stuff I talked about, the Honey Business talk about, how some of the human psychology stuff about how it relates to other countercultures and subcultures, and just what that means for where this will go, and your agency in that story. To me, made it, you know, that's what really made it more than, like I said, like the gun that's sitting in my gun closet, which I don't, you know, maybe would use every once in a while. I like to have it, like to know how to use it so that I, you know, if I need it, I've got it available to me. This is the thing that made me decide, holy shit, this is what I'm going to do. I want to become carry that metaphor through. I want to be an Olympic shooter, and I want to get out there doing it all the time, because I've got some agency, I've got some ability to change the world of this particular thing. It's so early and it's so open. That was, you know, kind of, I think, really critical to discovering Bitcoin, if you like, for me, is once I learned that the tool is not just a tool, it's also like a shelling point of culture, that it was a whole nother phenomena beyond, you know, just some cool censorship resistant money that might one day make me rich.
Yeah, right on. To that end, how has discovering Bitcoin changed you?
I mean, I think probably one of my favorite quotes I've read, I don't know if someone came out this before him, but Marty Ben, I think, is the first place I read this, is like, Bitcoin is hope. And it sounds kind of cheesy or whatever, but I think if you really dwell on that idea, it's quite a profound statement, in that, like, I think before that, you know, I had my interests and my things that I was doing, but Bitcoin, A, fundamentally has changed my life radically in the terms of, like, you know, I was just fortunate at the point that I decided to get in. I, you know, I wasn't very rich at all when I heard about Bitcoin. You know, I was self-employed and really kind of scraping by. But, you know, as soon as I got it, I put every dollar I could into it. So, I mean, I'm fortunate. This changed my life in the sense of, like, it's made me a lot richer and given me financial freedom. But not just that, because of something that I was so interested in, it was also like a shelling point, like we talked about. You know, the same thing with music and many other fringe interests I've had, where you get really involved in it, you start reading about it, and you become somewhat of a knowledge base on it. And so you connect to other people who are rabidly, passionately into this kind of thing. And there's an energy behind that. And people, you know, want to support, or they want to help out other people that have this like shared passion. And because of that, you know, like I managed to develop a whole new career, and, you know, which then led to me being able to work remotely and be location dependent and move on and stuff like that. So in many ways, it's like changed my life physically, right? You know, you've got more money, you've got the ability to do here, you've got a better career, what it might be. But underpinning all those things is the idea that, like, I think the most fundamental way that Bitcoin gives you hope, not just what, you know, different way to connect with people, change your life. The most fundamental thing, and this is the biggest power of Bitcoin and the strongest thing of the Bitcoin meme, is the idea that, like, you might have 0.00001 Bitcoin or whatever it might be, but there's this belief in the back of your mind that one day this is going to be worth $1 million, or this is going to be worth $10,000 or whatever it might be. And just how that fundamentally changes people's life, I think cannot be understated, right? The idea that your life might suck in every single way, but you've got this hope and this dream, this perpetual sense of hope that things will change. And what that does for your outlook on life and everything else that flows from it is just very, very powerful and has a lot of connotations. And I feel that way about Bitcoin. Like, you know, I've said this to many people. Like, imagine the whole Corona episode, if you didn't have Bitcoin. Like, it would have been so depressing, you know, like, what is there to look forward in life? You're like, where is the world going? You know, if this, but you know, the fact that you've got this thing that you believe in, and maybe it's a vain hope, you know, we don't know, who knows, you know, 20, 30 years, who knows what's going to happen. But the idea that there's this thing that you can devote your energy and your time to, that you can believe in, that you can focus on, that is a positive outcome in the world full of negativity and people trying to push your emotional buttons for all sorts of things like that. There, something which is pure and is, you know, no one is in control of it and you know, can't hurt you or can't be nasty to you because it's not a, you know, it's not a sentient being. I just think there's, you know, there's many of the same functions that are performed by religion, but it's something which I think in a world that we exist in today is a much easier the logical principle to reconcile the mind with, other than there's some imaginary person in the sky who created the world and that's why things are, right? You know? So I think, like, hope is the biggest one, you know, like, changed my life in many physical ways, like I said, but I think just simply the idea that you have something to believe in that's real, that's possible, that's credible, and what that does for your internal mental health, the way you feel about the world, that what you wake up and think every day, that absolutely, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's self-reinforcing in that respect, in that irrespective of whether or not Bitcoin succeeds in the way that a lot of people hope and believe that it will and think that it will, as you just pointed out, just the sheer dichotomy between not having a comprehension of Bitcoin or having a comprehension of Bitcoin over the last 3 years, you would just be led down to a path of nihilism without a doubt. And particularly if you were predisposed to those sorts of thoughts already. You know, we were talking to John Vallis on a couple of pods earlier or whatever, and like, that's kind of, if you're a curious enough person to try and understand what's going on around you and you want to engage in some deeper, more meaningful way, without a tool like Bitcoin in your arsenal, it can lead you to some pretty dark paths and some pretty tragic conclusions. So you flip the switch, and irrespective of whether it succeeds or not, you just have this thing in your back pocket where you just think, okay, well, you know, there's something. And as you were sort of drawing on the allusion to religion, God can sort of do that to an extent. However, having Bitcoin actually more meaningfully, actionably lubricates that belief and that hope into the future, as opposed to just hoping metaphorically.
Yeah. I'm not like a religious guy, you know, so I kind of look this somewhat more objectively than someone who perhaps might be would. But to me, you know, it's simply like religion is a social technology that serves many useful purposes. And that's why it has existed and it still exists, right? Because it gets certain jobs done in a very efficient way. And regardless of whether there is an omnipotent creator or creators or not, you know, like, you can make a very solid argument that, you know, religion has a place in society, whatever it may be. But I just feel like, as much as, you know, maybe you don't want to deify money, is not the best kind of like locus point for everyone's life. I think it is like a much better, because there's many other things that flow from Bitcoin, right? It's a showing point about, if we agree this, and then we are freedom loving people, we believe in property rights, we believe in these other kind of things. And so it's kind of as like a structure or like a skeleton on which you can build a lot of this kind of other stuff out, you know? And so I think it is, it's a very important thing for that. But like, as you said, it's also a positive one, right? You know, there's a lot of people I think who, you know, newcomers into Bitcoin, and classically, you know, if you look at what these people have been doing in the past, like, watch a lot of, you know, like podcasts and, you know, read a lot of things, and that, you know, often the, you know, the big political arguments, and like, what are you going to change in that, man? You're a sucker in someone else's game. They are all using you as a pawn to further their particular, you know, agenda, right? And there is nothing that you have to gain from that unless you suck up to their, you know, to the, I suck on their teat to climb the ladder of whatever they offer you, right? Mm-hmm. And like, it's a very trite meme and a trite point of like, Bitcoin fixes this just by Bitcoin or whatever. But I mean, there is quite a nugget of kernel of truth in that thing of like, this is real tangible action that you can take, right? And there is a massive big step between you buying $20 of Bitcoin and, you know, the Federal Reserve and the financial system and the fiat system fundamentally changing, right? There's many, many dominoes that have to fall between those two. But in comparison to many of the options that you have today to fundamentally change the way things works, you know, it gives you far more agency, right? You know, that like meme of like, fix the money, fix the world. Again, yeah, I think it's all trite, but there's also quite a bit of truth to that. And I think just simply the fact that you can take real action. I mean, like to me, you know, like I learned to program and I'm working at a, you know, Swan Bitcoin, like a Bitcoin company now, you know, like I feel like I give a good, you know, most of my, if not all my energy towards forwarding Bitcoin. But, you know, that's still like, even if you have nothing, none of that kind of stuff, and you're just buying $20, right? You're taking tangible action. And again, coming back to that meme of hope, mm-hmm. just the fact that you don't feel powerless, right? You can do something. You can like, smash buy on Swan Bitcoin, $20 of Bitcoin, right? Gives you some sense of like, you are not helpless. There is something that you can do, which, you know, is making, it might be a small thing, but it is making a real tangible change in a revolution, right? And
totally.
So, I mean, I think like even if this is going to, let's imagine in 5 years, this all falls apart and fails, and there is a massive benefit in Bitcoin and just the way that for 10 years, or how many, geez, what is it, 2009?
14 now.
13 years now, it's given people like a sense of hope and a sense of purpose and kept them from falling into that like endless pool of nihilism that you described. Like, yeah. You know, I'm kind of working on a talk about this at the moment where, you know, like kind of making the argument of like, could that not be the point of Bitcoin? Like, you know, obviously it's a robust monetary network and it's a great, you know, technology and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, is there not an argument to be made that perhaps the whole point of Bitcoin is just hope, right? It's just the idea of like something to like unite people and to give them a sense of purpose and a sense of a better future. And let's imagine that we know that, say, here's a hypothetical example. Let's imagine we know that when the block subsidy runs out, the Bitcoin will break and it's broken forever and you can't like reboot it. Like when that's done, it's done, right? So you've got till 2140 is a window of like how long you can use Bitcoin, it will exist, but you know after that it's going to be done. But just imagine how different the world will be by virtue of having this sound money, freedom-loving money, and this community of people will build around it for that amount of time. Even if Bitcoin was to break at the end of the block subsidy, would not perhaps its purpose have been just to fundamentally change, you know, the arc of humanity and the dialogue and the nature of civilization for 100 years? And even if that was all that it achieved, would that not be a great achievement? You know, so, I don't know, thought experiment, but
the cycle.
But it's these are things that people don't, you know, tend to talk or think about it in Bitcoin. I think they're important things to have a bit more of a mature, well thought out train of thought and steel man arguments about.
100%. I think the whole concept of hope and the change of psyche. I am curious to know on that point of hope and a lot of that positivity that inherently comes from engaging with Bitcoin. You mentioned in your Honey Badger talk that you used to play in metal bands, and I'm curious to know how that would affect heavy metal in terms of what you like personally. Would you write more melodious songs? Would there be a little bit more melody, or would it still be just balls to the wall, fuck you, this is just a giant riff and I'm going to scream my head off?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to bring up. No, I mean, I wouldn't think it would change the music, right? Because, I mean, like I've had this discussion with people before. Like, I mean, it's interesting with metal in particular because, like, if you were to categorize what emotion it's expressing, primarily it'd be like anger, frustration, things like this, right, which are seen as kind of negative emotions. And interestingly enough, the kind of perspective or what people seem to assume is that you want to get away from these things, but they're, you know, all an important part of the emotional spectrum. And, you know, the idea like if you're looking at the world as it is today and there is not some part of it that does not make you violently angry, there is something wrong with you, in my opinion, right? You know, there are fucked up things that go on in the world. There are things that give you an honest reason to be angry and to be unhappy, right? And yeah, another good example would be like, you know, when you go to the gym, it's fantastic music to use in the gym because, you know, it makes you feel pumped up, makes you feel energized, like you want to get out and, you know, do something, right? You know, hit something or whatever. And that's, you know, and why you're in the gym, because you want to change who you are, because you want to improve things. You don't want to sit or rest on your laurels, right? You don't want to get out and do stuff, right? So, I mean, I think like that, I wouldn't change it because that has an important emotional functionality. It's a very kind of misunderstood or demonetized one in Western society, but it's a very important one in our life and the kind of a range of emotions. But I mean, to kind of come to the greater thing you're talking about, yeah, it's quite interesting because, you know, I think a lot of why I played music when I was a kid, you know, was wanting to do something which was maybe a little edgy, out there, exciting, different, you know, kind of, and that gave me an opportunity to see the world, get out of this tiny, shitty country and the fucking arse end of the world, connect with other people, do something that was different and memorable, right? And I kind of feel like, Bitcoin, unfortunately for me, does all those things a lot better than music does. You know, I actually played my first show in December over here in Mexico. You know, I haven't been able to do it for since 2019, really, because of COVID and everyone else in my band who's still in New Zealand is trapped there, was trapped there. But, yeah, it's interesting to come back to it after that sort of break, and that's certainly the longest I've ever gone in my life by a massive margin without, like, really touching guitar and thinking about it. It's just interesting after having that kind of space from coming back to it about how I think many of the things that attracted me to music are things that I get and see in Bitcoin. But you know, it's partly that it does it better than music or metal music does it. But I think it's also like the role of that has changed, right? You know, like when I was first, you know, I was a teenager in the 90s, you know, and doing music, right? You know, that was like, there was still this thing of like music was something that would change the world and had so much attention and cultural value. And now it's like becoming more and more like wallpaper, which is like what music has been for, you know, 99% of human civilization. It's like they were the guys who made your food or cleaned your house or cooked your dishes. That's the role and the status of a musician. It's only a small anomaly in our kind of society where they were kind of like super influential people. And, you know, COVID, another good example, like, you know, I feel like the amount of people that, regardless of your position on the whole thing and issues like vaccines or whatever, the amount of people in music who like really took a stand or did something controversial about that, to me, was such an eye-opener of like, you know, you would think if this is the 60s, 70s, there would be a lot of musicians making some very controversial statements on both sides of the argument. Because that is the role of music, right? Or at least the way that I grew up seeing it. It's like this thing that was a vehicle to encourage discussion in society and change society. And that's a role of art. But like really, you know, like what did you see out of that when it comes to artists of all stripes? No one. Everyone was afraid of like, am I going to lose money if I say something too controversial?
Total,
right?
Co-option.
So, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so I feel like to me, like maybe you could say the same thing about like YouTubers or things like that. Maybe they've kind of assumed their cultural role. But I feel like Bitcoin is the counterculture, you know, just kind of fit into some of the ideas behind that Honeybees talk as well. But, you know, it is kind of like the counterculture, the rock and roll of our era, right? You know, this is the revolutionary, world-changing thing to be involved with that has that energy and sucks all those people who are of that mindset and of that, hold those values and have that kind of drive and that intelligence. They're all attracted to this thing where, you know, would have been music, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, whereas now I feel like, you know, like Bitcoin is the thing which is kind of assume that role in society. So I think, you know, they're very similar in many ways, but I think if you're, I mean, there's reasons you play music because music is fucking great and you want to musically express yourself and there's an amazing thing in that in and of itself. Like, forget about what it means, who listens to it, whatever. There's something amazing about playing an instrument. But I think if you're talking about many of the other side things around it, where if I'm honest, when I was like a kid, there were a lot of what attracted me to learn to play music in the first place. Yeah, they now provide a lot better than by Bitcoin than music itself does.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I'll never get tired of listening or playing a massive heavy riff there. I just I like that a lot. I'm curious to know, you know, I asked this of John. This is a relatively new question that I've sort of introduced, but how much is enough? You know, we talk about stacking sats, smash buying, greed in this respect is relatively altruistic, and there's a net benefit there and positive. But is there a point in time where you've kind of stacked enough that you feel like, all right, I'm cool now, and if this does what it's supposed to do, I think we're going to be sweet? And or do you just keep going?
Man, that's such a high question to answer. And I think it's obviously a personal thing, right?
Sure.
If, you know, for some people put a higher value on just the idea of people, some people are more money oriented than others. And I think, like, generally people who are not so money oriented aren't as into the space as people who are, because that's the obvious connection and the strongest narrative is about that, you know, the sound money kind of thing, I think is the best one that we've had so far and seems to, like, definitely get that. You know, the numbers and the interest and collection for the most amount of people. But I mean, like, I kind of have a different thing. Like, I've never been a money guy. Like, I've never been, like, super, super rich. You know, like, when I was in the police, for example, and I had, like, a super scheme where every dollar that would automatically get pulled out of my paycheck and put in the government would contribute another one. So I never really thought about investing, because none of it's going to compete this, like, double your money guaranteed thing, you know, which I had on autopilot going on. So, like, why would I even, like, really care about stocks or bonds or property or this kind of stuff? And I was so interested in music, I was like, well, I'm just going to throw my money at this thing, which is so cool. I'm so into it. I can't help myself. I feel like, you know, Bitcoin is something that definitely changed that and kind of shift that around and change my perspective on that and kind of and inherently got me into it. But I do feel like, you know, I'm someone where, you know, I feel like I kind of got, I mean, like, how enough is enough, right? I think, like, you know, when you get more money, it's not like you won't necessarily want, like, a bigger car or stuff. There's, you know, bigger dreams of whatever you're into that are, of course, made available by money or are heavily dependent on that. And, you know, the biggest one is time, right? If you've got, like, all the money in the world, you don't need to work on anything other than what interests you, you know? And so, like, yeah, I think, like, it's hard to divorce money from, if you're honest, it's hard to divorce money from, like, from anything. But I think, to the point you're saying about, like, it's interesting to me of, like, I'm certainly not, like, one of these how would I put it? Like, Bitcoin is saving is using kind of people. I'm kind of like, I mean, I can see the argument, but I don't think I'd, like, totally gel with that myself, right? You know, and, you know, this has come from someone who was, like, stacking sets long before that was a thing. Like, you know, I cottoned on, you know, in 2014, I want to put, like, a stable amount of my money every week that I can, the max amount that I can, into this thing and save it, because this is probably going to outperform anything else I put my money in, right? And DCAing is the obvious way to do it. But I mean, I think at the same point, you've got to realize, like, you know, I'm at the point now where I'm getting to the age where I'm going to think, well, you know, how much longer have I got my life? You know what I mean? Like, at a certain point, your health is going to start deteriorating. And if you're saving for this unknown thing, like, you know, and some people, that's passing on to the next generation, right? You know,
time preference is slowly increasing.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that kind of meme, I don't know, it can kind of play itself out a little bit. And I feel like, especially when it comes to things like Twitter, this becomes this kind of like, people are trying to outload time preference other people, which is kind of contradictory to what the whole kind of principle is about, really. It's about, like, preserving yourself, right? When you're trying to be more cheap or poor than someone else. And yeah, I mean, I guess that leads to, like, kind of why, another reason why I think, like, to me, like, I've got a certain amount and I'm pretty much at what I want, have been for quite some time. But to me, what's more important is the, you know, I think it's, I feel like I've more or less got enough. I mean, you can always want more, you always be saving more, but I think what's more important to me is to spend it, because like, to share it with other people, to use it, to show people the utility of it, to kind of bring more people into the orange coin cult, if you like, by giving them some sort of skin in the game and some satoshis, right? You know, that's a very important part of it. And I think, like, this is obvious, right? Like, let's imagine when Bitcoin was a dollar and you had a thousand. I mean, you'd be saving your money in Bitcoin, right? When Bitcoin's $1 million, you're going to be, like, some point you're saying, well, you know, like, I could keep saving Bitcoin, or I could, like, I haven't got a house, I haven't got a car and stuff because I've been such a pauper forever saving. Like, now it makes a lot more sense to sell 10% of my stuff, let's just say, right? You know? And so I think that's a natural part of the, almost the game theory of Bitcoin in and of itself. It's like, the more that the price will appreciate, the more incentivized people will be. And it comes to a point where it's silly not to spend it, which means, you know, which prevents it becoming this, you know, there's this meme like, if no one's using it, it becomes this rock that has no utility because no one wants to exchange it for goods or services. And there's always going to be someone who's got like a crazy amount of money and it's all in Bitcoin. And they're like, hey, you know, I want to buy a car. Would you take Bitcoin for it? I'll give you a bit of a discount because it would be easier if you just take the Bitcoin rather than me have to sell it and deal with all the KYC stuff or whatever. And so if someone gets more money for less, of course, you know, so I mean, I think that waterfall effect goes on and it's a very important part of the story and the economy. So long-winded answer to say like, yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like, you know, I'm comfortable with where I'm at. You can always have more, but I'm not like dying or, you know, I'm kind of more at the point, to be honest, you're thinking like, what's my perfect work-life balance and how can I, you know, feel comfortable about, especially when, you know that you know, 2 or 3 years, you know, what you spend now, you know, I've got this thing, for example, I remember I spent 0.05 Bitcoin on a beer in New Zealand, right? And now that's, seems like a very silly idea and seemed like a lot sillier idea when Bitcoin is like $70,000, right? You know, like what have you spent now, especially at this point of the market, is you're going to have that thinking, but like, you know, what else is the money for, right? And I think if that's true, what could be more, if you're all about Bitcoin, you believe in Bitcoin, it's where the majority of money is, what could be more than spending it on the beer at the bar, which shows the barman, hey, this shit is real, it's money, people use it. And if I accept it, people are actually going to use it for goods and services. And now this barman I know, he's got like 4 Bitcoin just from what people spend on beers in like 2014, 2013 and shit like that, you know. So, I mean, I think like when you view it that way, it's almost like giving back or contributing back into the ecosystem, to the community, to the, you know, the omnipresent orange god, you know, is spending it. So I think it's an important part of it is like, you know, you've got to be on the way up, you've got to be throwing some over the side, you know, making it rain a little for people, because that's, you know, how this thing manifests and how it becomes real.
Paying it forward. Yeah, 100%. How do you explain Bitcoin to someone? How do you try and orange pill them?
Like, I'm not a big fan of orange pilling people, to be honest with you, because, you know, I've had, you know, many experiences. Like, I remember a great example, one of my best friends in New Zealand, for his birthday in 2014, I gave him, do you remember like a change tip? Were you around then?
No.
And it was this thing where you could kind of, it wasn't integrated with Twitter, but you could do like kind of the way you've got some of these bots or whatever. This is like going back a little, so I'm trying to remember. But you could like at change tip $20 or at change tip a beer, right? And that would give them from your change tip account, which is linked to your Twitter, it would transfer it to their, if they had it set up, it would just automatically transfer it to there. If they didn't have it, they'd get an email, they'd get a notification, I think, and it would auto-post something like that saying, hey, someone tip you on change tip, go here to sign up and collect your free, you know, the Bitcoin that you've been given, right? So I remember I gave this dude, 0.05, I think it was, or 0.1 or something like that for his birthday, and then change tip shut down in 2017, and I got this email, or 2016, I can't remember what it was, got this email saying, hey, you know, this guy never collected the money. Like, you know, still to this day, I've got people like that, or I've got another really good friend who I convinced to buy, like, would have been like $300-$400. And he would have bought like 5-6 Bitcoins and then got to like 700-800. He sold it all and he's never like gone back. He's never like thought, maybe that was a good idea. Maybe, you know, like this looks like the market's really low and this thing hasn't gone away. And, you know, this guy was like, you know, using Poloniex and stuff and like way back in the day, you know, so he knows what he's, you know, kind of talking about, but, you know, just people, I feel like, you know, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make it drink. And I think that's a really important part of Bitcoin is the more that you oversell it to people. And I feel like, I feel already this is, some people say we're not selling hard enough. I kind of feel personally like we're overselling it already to people that, you know, that don't need it, don't want it, aren't interested into it. And I think that creates like fair weather friends of Bitcoin, right? These people who are going to be here for the good stuff, but the moment the price goes down, they sell. And this is, I think, the whole FTX thing, I mean, slightly different issue, but it's somewhat of an example of like these people who don't understand the value proposition of, theoretically, Bitcoin shouldn't have dumped anywhere near as much as it did. But obviously, there's a lot of people who held it, which, you know, as soon as the price started going down, I'm thinking, shit, this is scary. I don't know where this is going. I thought I understood what this thing is, but it's not going up all the time. This guy, Plan B, said it's going to go up forever, and now it's going lower than what it is. You know, it's gone under this rainbow thing. What's going on? You know, so these people, if they're not kind of like warriors, soldiers for Bitcoin, right? You know, that they'll undermine the movement in a sense, right? So I kind of feel like I don't go too hard on preaching this kind of stuff. And generally I'm not like, I don't have like go to line because I don't try and sell people on it. Generally, most people I know, like, you know, if you've known me for like 5 minutes, you know, I've got stuff to do with Bitcoin. And a lot of people ask me questions about it. And, you know, certainly I've like orange pilled plenty of people onto it, but I'm always trying to like, man, just buy a small amount and like wait, and like watch this thing for a little while, see how it goes. And I always try to give them some shit to read. Like to me, I'm not a particularly big fan of the Bitcoin Standard, but I mean, I think it's like, it's a very good introductory book and it gets the job done, right? You know, as far as like making people understand, I think better than anything else that's existed up to this point. Mm-hmm. It's a thing that gets the job done of like, I think most people read it and say like, okay, I understand this thing now. Or like, maybe they're not like all on board, but they get it, right? They get why Bitcoin is what it is. But, you know, I'm a big fan of Andreas Antonopoulos myself. Like, I feel like his talks and what he spoke to about some things were a lot more kind of human. It's not just like this is some investment thing or it's like some sound way to protect your money. It's like, this is shit about freedom. This is about human expression. This is about connecting people with other people. To me, that's very important. So I tend to give people a bunch of the stuff to read, but I'm always like, let them do it, man. Let them read it. Let them, don't try and like check up in 2 weeks, say, well, maybe you might ask a question, but like, don't be hounding these motherfuckers, right? You know, because, you know, if people don't understand it for themselves, like Bitcoin is freedom. Bitcoin is about personal choice, which means you have to choose it, right? You know, you can't be forced into it. You can't use it because you have to use it. You should choose it because you voluntarily want to be there, right? And it's a very important part of, I think, the culture of Bitcoin and what it's about is that kind of thing, you know. But it's an interesting point, you know, because, I mean, like, when you work for a company like Swan, you know, I mean, I there are certain things, you know, ideologically or whatever about, you know, the approach that our company takes that, you know, wouldn't be the way that I would do it or, you know, seem more contradictory to me. But, you know, I think there is a very good argument, and this is probably the thing which really, the more that Bitcoin's got bigger and the more that I've got involved in the ecosystem that causes me the most amount of mental friction, is that's all very good and well to have that principle and to rest your laurels and say, well, hey, man, I'm perfectly clean and I never ever sold Bitcoin to anyone. But to use like a perhaps a military metaphor, right? It's like there is like a like, here's you, Bitcoin, on this mountain, and here's every other fucking altcoin on this other mountain. And there's this plane in between, right? This unclaimed territory, this terrain, which is open, right? And that's
Canny Valley.
The wealth, the wealth of you know, the world, that the meme power, the mentality, the focus of the whole world. And if Bitcoin doesn't get near and claim that space, altcoins will, right? You know, and this whole revolution could be undermined by the majority of the world buying Ripple and Bitcoin being some small fraction of the total market cap of cryptocurrencies. And so I think, like, as much as, you know, like, here's me saying you shouldn't orange pill people. On the other hand, I think it befalls on someone to do that, because if we don't claim those minds, if you like, that mind share, other things will. Maybe I'm saying like, thank you for your sacrifice to all these other people that are getting on Twitter and creating ridiculous, you know, meme pump accounts and whatever on YouTube. I think, like, if you ask me, Bitcoin is for anyone, not for everyone, right? You know, it's like, it's not something, it's anyone can be involved, but not everyone can, you know, own, you know, more than a couple of Satoshis, right? Just because the limited supply. But, you know, I think there is orange pilling that needs to be done, and it's an important part of that. You know, I'm not trying to, what I'm saying is I'm not trying to diminish it, because, you know, maybe it's greater people than me who can get out there and fight that battle, because it is a very important one to be fought.
100%. Yeah, it's you don't want to be too evangelical about it, because you will just come across as a JW or something, you know, which is, you know, it is what it is, but softly, and you catch more flies with honey, you know.
It just takes time, dude, you know, like, I mean, like, you know, like, some, I think everyone is gonna, you know, pardon the pun, come to silver at some point, you know. But you've got to let people do it in their own time. You know, just like they know the resources there. You give them the information. Maybe it's going to take them 2 or 3 years to actually come back after multiple times and actually read the fucking thing you gave them. But, I mean, you can't force them, because, like, if they don't know the value of what they're holding, they will sell it. When the price goes down, they'll panic, because, you know, they never understood why they are there in the first place, right?
Yeah. You just got to not hand out too many books because generally you don't get them back and then they're also not read. Yeah. So you just think, fuck.
Yeah.
Rigel, this has been an awesome conversation, man. Really, really rad.
Likewise, man.
I've learned a lot and it's just been a real pleasure. So thanks for sharing your scarce time, finite energy on discovering Bitcoin.
Likewise.
And, I look forward to doing it again with you soon.
Thanks, man. Yeah, me too. Just...